Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week, I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I have a must list for us so we know what we should be paying attention to this week. The Golden Globes are coming up, but there's no article this time around for who they're guessing will win. But there is a little one, so I'm going to read that, a short one. And I do have a list of rom-coms because, I don't know, they're just so light and nice. And I have a few other articles to round out the time this week. So let's get to that must list. The first Emily Henry rom-com adaptation, Tom Hiddleston returning to The Night Manager and the Golden Globes, top this week's must list. All Out on Broadway and Maria Sue stories round out our picks for the weekend. This is by Tiffany Kelly. I can't believe it, but somehow we made it to 2026. And thankfully, amid the chaos that's already got us swirling just a week into the new year, there's a lot to look forward to. After this week's Traitors premiere, I can't wait for more episodes. The buzz about The Pitt Season 2 has me incredibly excited. And then there's the upcoming 50th season of Survivor, which we just commemorated with a trio of exclusives, including a cover story, photos, and video. In what RuPaul recently called shady times, I hope you're finding the light, too. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. First on our list, People We Meet on Vacation. The first adaptation of Emily Henry novel is here to start the year on a romantic note. Emily Badger from My Lady Jane and Tom Blythe from The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, play Poppy and Alex, two close friends who take yearly trips to new places together, platonically, of course. Book fans will notice several changes to the plot and locales in the movie that's streaming on Netflix, but the story remains an enjoyable, bubbly rom-com. Bader especially shines as an extroverted, free-spirited travel journalist, while Molly Shannon and Alan Ruck fully utilize their limited screen time as Poppy's eccentric parents. The Night Manager is next. Tom Hiddleston returns to his Emmy-nominated role as Jonathan Pine, a former hotel employee recruited into the world of international espionage. Season 2, streaming on Prime Video, picks up 9 years later, with Pine working for MI6 and encountering some old gun-running acquaintances. The Golden Globes. Awards season has officially begun! Nikki Glaser returns to host the Globes on Sunday, ready to roast film and TV stars from the past year. Tune in to see which titles take home the top awards and stay for Glaser's inevitable cosplay. All Out. Jon Stewart, Ray Romano, and Heidi Gardner are among the rotating cast of celebs reading Simon Rich's short stories from the Nederlander Theater stage in NYC. But the true secret weapon is pop soul band Lawrence, who truly go, well, all out. And we have Marayi Rasu stories. The prolific Edgardo Rivera Martinez has been celebrated as one of Peru's most daring writers for decades. Marayi Rasu, his first collection of stories to receive an English translation, expands his reach, introducing readers to his tough yet richly poetic world. That's our must list. The first Emily Henry rom-com adaptation, Tom Hiddleston returning to The Night Manager, and The Golden Globes are topping this week's must list. So here's the Golden Globe article I have. Nikki Glaser says Steve Martin sent her a joke to tell at the Golden Globes and then took it back. That's too far. Glaser is set to host the 83rd Golden Globes ceremony on Sunday. This is by Rachel Shufelt. Nikki Glaser is in full Golden Globes preparation mode. The comedian, who's returning to host her second ceremony in a row on Sunday, has had some familiar names offering their services. I saw Judd Apatow last night at a gig and said, "Please, send me any notes you have," Glazer told The Hollywood Reporter in an interview published Tuesday. He seemed to have no notes, but he's someone who's hosted the Directors Guild Awards. He's done this before. Who else? Steve Martin sent in a joke through one of my writers. That was so nice. Then he said afterwards, "Actually, tell her, don't do that joke. That's too far." And he was right. I did love the joke, but I don't think I could say that. Martin, of course, is a nominee himself in the category of Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Series, Musical, or Comedy for his role in Only Murders in the Building. A repeat performance meant that Glazer had more nominated movies and TV shows to watch, although she admits in her interview that she didn't see them all. You can't watch everything, and you certainly can't listen to all the podcasts. God, Glazer said. But I've watched most of everything. I still have a couple more to go. Train Dreams, The Secret Agent. I'm not someone who can really sit down and watch something. She also spent some of her TV hours catching up on older HBO series. My big project this year was The Wire, and I wish that was nominated. That's all I want to talk about. But I saw One Battle After Another twice. I loved it so much. Marty Supreme? Insane. It's a really good year for movies. Song Sung Blue? Loved it. In a December 2024 interview with Entertainment Weekly, Glazer explained her thoughts about stepping onto the Globe's stage for last year's show. "I have to say who I am first," the comic said. "I have to be a little softer and more self-deprecating because I'm not as well known. I can't just come out swinging. They'll be like, 'Who is this lady and why does she think she has a right to talk to us this way?' I can't come in with the same annihilating venom as I did at the Tom Brady roast. With status comes the ability to punch harder." The 83rd Golden Globes ceremony airs Sunday, January 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on CBS and Paramount+. That was Nikki Glazer, says Steve Martin sent her a joke to tell at the Golden Globes and then took it back. That's too far. And it was by Rachel Schofield. Speaking of Marty Supreme, here is the true story behind Marty Supreme, all about real-life ping-pong star Marty Riceman and the antics that inspired the film. Josh Safdie's film is no biopic, but it's heavily indebted to the life and talents of ping-pong champ Marty Riceman. This is by Randall Colburn. Table tennis is a sport, not a game, in Josh Safdie's Marty Supreme. Like many of the director's previous films, including Good Time in 2017 and Uncut Gems in 2019, Marty Supreme hinges on its wrecking ball protagonist, a figure so charismatic and careless that they can't help but shatter everyone in their orbit. Here we have Marty Mauser, played by Timothy Chalamet, a ping-pong prodigy with the soul of a hustler who believes he's destined for greatness. Whether he achieves it is up to interpretation, but the film is making waves, exceeding box office expectations and nabbing 3 Golden Globe nominations, including one for Best Picture Drama. Any movie built on such a captivating and polarizing character is bound to have folks wondering if they're based on a real-life figure. Marty Supreme isn't a biopic, but as Safdie has said in numerous interviews, the film was inspired by The Money Player, The Confessions of America's Greatest Table Tennis Champion and Hustler, a 1974 autobiography from ping pong champ Marty Riceman. Having read that book, which was about a table tennis player who believed in this thing and had a dream that no one respected, it instantly was like, okay, well, this world can be a great conduit to kind of explore those themes, Safdie explained to NPR. So how much of Reisman made his way into Mauser? Let's discuss it. Who was Marty Reisman? Marty Reisman was born in Manhattan in 1930, the son of a Russian immigrant who left his taxi-driving, poker-playing father when Reisman was just 10. He took up table tennis shortly thereafter and was the city junior champion by the age of 13. As noted in a 1977 Sports Illustrated profile, Reisman was labeled the bad boy of ping pong by the time he was 16, when he won the national junior title. In 1948, he was part of the three-man U.S. team at the World Championships in London. As he traveled the world competing, he made cash on the side by exporting and selling contraband. "Smuggling never bothered me," Reisman told the outlet. "Table tennis players have to survive on their wiles. A player who depended on exhibition fees could starve. The top players were either gamblers, smugglers, or both. I had already won more than 175 trophies, but I couldn't eat them." Reisman, skinny and 6 feet tall, came to be known as the Needle due to both his physical appearance and forehand kill shot, which the London press dubbed the Atomic Blast. That kill shot helped him win the British Open table tennis tournament, which Reisman named second in international importance to the World Championships in his autobiography. He was the first American to do so. Like the film's Marty Mauser, Reisman put his showmanship on display as an opening act for the Harlem Globetrotters. Later, he'd run underground table tennis clubs that were frequented by celebrities such as Dustin Hoffman, Kurt Vonnegut, and other offbeat prodigy in chess champ Bobby Fischer, as reported in Reisman's New York Times obituary. Famed writer and director David Mamet, who cameos in Marty Supreme, is also said to have attended Marty's clubs. In 2010, 2 years before his death at 82 from complications of heart and lung ailments, Reisman founded Table Tennis Nation. All told, he earned 22 major table tennis titles, including one at the age of 67, making him the oldest player to win a national championship in a racket sport. He was married twice and had a daughter, Debbie, from his first marriage. Is Marty Supreme based on a true story? While Marty Supreme is only loosely inspired by Reisman, there are several sequences and character details plucked from his life. Reisman, for example, worked as a shoe salesman, much like Marty. He didn't quit or loot the safe, however. Instead, he was fired for consistently showing up late, according to Sports Illustrated. Reisman's verve and competitive spirit, for example, mirror Marty's relentless drive. "Though I needed to get the adrenaline flowing, the money is nothing. The excitement, everything," Reisman told Sports Illustrated. "I never played a game for fun in my life." Marty's brashness is on full display in the film when, while traveling for a competition, he ditches the pitiful London hotel where all of the competitors are staying for a room at the high-end Ritz. As detailed in his autobiography, Reisman pulled a similar trick. "We had been staying at the Royal Hotel, which had more fleas than royalty. Our rooms were closet size and smelled of decayed wallpaper," he wrote. "During the British Open Championship, the London Times had called me the Danny Kaye of table tennis. Well, I reasoned, the Royal was no place for Danny Kaye." He and a friend moved into the much more expensive Cumberland Hotel and, as Marty does in the film, charged expenses to the English Table Tennis Association. As previously noted, Reisman also toured with the Harlem Globetrotters, where he performed skits that included playing with frying pans to the tune of Mary Had a Little Lamb. During those shows, per Sports Illustrated, he perfected his signature trick of standing a cigarette on the end of the far side of the table and then blithely breaking it in two with a forehand smash. "I had the time of my life touring with the Harlem Globetrotters," he wrote in his autobiography. For a while, people even stopped sneering at the fact that table tennis was all I did. While there's no evidence that Reisman played against a sea lion, as Marty does in the film, the real-life legend did once play a chimpanzee. That ape had a lot of native ability, Reisman told Sports Illustrated. Is Milton Rockwell based on a real person? While Kevin O'Leary's wealthy Milton Rockwell is a fictional character created for the film, his success in the pen industry appears to be a nod to Reisman's trick of selling ballpoint pens overseas in a bid to make extra cash. They cost me 50 cents each and were a way of meeting expenses. Ballpoints were new in Europe, and I was able to get $5 apiece for them, he wrote in his autobiography. Is the story about bees and Auschwitz true? One of the more memorable detours in Marty Supreme involves Marty's friend and colleague, Bella, played by Giza Ruhring, telling a story about his time as a prisoner at the Auschwitz concentration camp during World War II. During a bomb disposal mission, he rubbed honey from a beehive all over his skin and later let his famished fellow prisoners lick it off his body. As Safdie told The Guardian, this is a true story about a Hungarian Jew and table tennis player named Eljosi Ehrlich. I learned more about the Holocaust in that little story than from some movies that are only about the Holocaust, he said. And where can I watch Marty Supreme? Marty Supreme is currently playing in theaters. That was the true story behind Marty Supreme, all about real-life ping-pong star Marty Reisman and the antics that inspired the film. It was by Randall Colburn. The Pit is out and started again on HBO. Here's an article, The Pit Stars React to Season 2 Premiere from Dana and Langdon's Returns to Abandoned Baby Cliffhanger. Noah Wiley, Patrick Ball, Catherine Lanasa, and Sepida Moafi talk about where we find their characters at the top of the season 2 shift. This is by Ashley Boucher. And it says there's a spoiler alert here. I've read the article. It's the first show of the season. While it is talking about the show, it's really not any spoilers in here, so I'm jumping in. And it does lead with, this article contains spoilers for The Pit, Season 2, Episode 1, titled 7 a.m. It's time to catch up with the doctors of The Pit. The Season 2 premiere of everyone's favorite medical drama begins at the start of a sure-to-be-busy 4th of July shift, despite one new medical student calling the 7 a.m. hour a bit of a lull. We quickly learn that Dr. Robbie, played by Noah Wiley, is on his last day before taking a 3-month sabbatical. Charge nurse Dana Evans, played by Catherine Lanasa, is back, despite saying she was done at the end of season one, and Dr. Langdon has completed rehab for his addiction to benzos. But it's not necessarily a happy reunion for everyone. And added to the mix is Dr. Baran Al-Hashimi, played by Sepide Moafi, the new attending physician who will be covering for Robbie while he's out. Robbie arrives at the hospital to discover that Langdon is covering the holiday shift for another doctor, something he wasn't expecting. He was hoping their shifts wouldn't overlap and that he could get out of Dodge before having to see him, Wiley tells Entertainment Weekly. Ball adds that there is a lot of damage to clean up between Langdon and Wiley, though a confrontation between the two is delayed when Robbie sends Langdon to work in triage. Meanwhile, we're introduced to Al-Hashimi when she tasks Whitaker, played by Jaren Howell, who is now overseeing two medical students, and Javadi, played by Shabana Aziz, with a mock case. Let's just say Robbie isn't immediately impressed with Al-Hashimi's methods. I don't know that he would really have been totally accepting of anybody that was moving into his role, Wiley says of Al-Hashimi's arrival. Dana returns to find a new nurse, Emma, ready to shadow her. Lanasa tells Entertainment Weekly that there will be more focus on the nurses this season. There's a nurse's episode where we definitely get a feel of the breadth of what they do at any given day, the actress says, adding the nurses handle a lot of the dirty work. While in triage, Langdon finds Louis Cloverfield, played by Ernest Hardin Jr., waiting to be seen for a toothache. Louis, a regular in the ER, is one of the patients Langdon stole meds from in season one, and he wastes no time apologizing. It is really tricky when coming to terms with the ways in which you have wronged people, Ball says of the apology, but Louis casually accepts, leading Langdon to realize that probably there's a lot of people that don't hate him near as much as he anticipates, Ball says. Langdon is drawn away from Louis when a baby is found in the waiting room bathroom, a mysterious storyline that will continue throughout the season. At the very end of the episode, Dr. Samira Mohan, played by Supriya Ganesh, and Al Hashimi are checking in on the baby when the new doctor has an intense reaction that Moafi says is rooted in a big spoiler. Her reaction to that baby, the abandoned baby, will make more sense later on in the season, Moafi promises. The shift continues Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 6 p.m. Pacific Time on HBO Max. That's The Pitt Stars React to Season 2 Premiere, from Dana and Langdon's Returns to Abandoned Baby Cliffhanger, and it was by Ashley Boucher. Jimmy Fallon likens fan frenzy for heated rivalries Hudson Williams to Beatlemania, one of the hottest audiences we've ever had. The 24-year-old star made his first late-night appearance on The Tonight Show Wednesday with a massive crowd waiting outside the studio. This is by Mikishana Pierre. Even a longtime TV host like Jimmy Fallon was surprised by the response to heated rivalry star Hudson Williams making his late-night debut on The Tonight Show. The frenzy began before the 24-year-old actor even took the stage at NBC's 30 Rockefeller Plaza, with footage shared on social media showing lines of fans beginning to form overnight for a chance to see Williams. "The night before I came into work, someone called and said, 'Hey, there's a line outside 30 Rock that's probably 150 people long,'" Fallon recalled over the phone with Entertainment Weekly. "I go, 'For Hudson?' They go, 'For Hudson Williams.' They were freaking out. Fans flew here. I'm like, this is so fun." When Fallon made his own way to the building the day of, he remembered walking through the crowd and admitted it was so cool to see. It definitely wasn't the reaction Fallon and his Tonight Show crew expected when they originally booked the Canadian star for his appearance. "It's so funny when you get to see these kind of almost unknowns become household names almost overnight," Fallon noted. "We booked Hudson probably 6 weeks ago when the show had some buzz, but it wasn't the biggest thing on everyone's minds, you know? That's definitely changed as the modestly made Canadian series about rival Major League Hockey players in a secret romance has become a global phenomenon on HBO Max. The massive response from fans has led to a swift season 2 renewal, and its stars, Williams and Connor Story, becoming viral sensations. Both actors have taken to their rise to stardom as ducks to water, which Fallon says was especially fun when meeting Williams for the show. "To have him show up and he's excited, he was in the best mood," the host says. "He was like, 'I can't believe this.' Less than 2 years ago, he was working at the old spaghetti factory in Canada as a server, and now people are waiting in line, screaming his name, and going nuts." The late-night veteran called Wednesday's attendance one of the hottest audiences we've ever had, adding that he would put it up there with BTS or Harry Styles. I mean, they went bonkers. Fallon credited his production team for putting on one of the best shows we've done all year, praising the writers for the monologue with Williams and the Roots co-creator Tariq Trotter. The bits featuring Chelsea Handler, Sophie Turner, and the performance by Sienna Spiro. The whole show was great, but Hudson was the reason everyone was in such a hype mood, the Saturday Night Live alum added. I mean, people were going crazy. Even just mentioning his name, they went wild, and I said it's almost deafening. It's almost like seeing those black and white videos of the Beatles or something, and you go, how could it be that loud in one room? And the fans went especially crazy during a segment of the show where Williams taught Fallon the much-talked-about hockey stretching exercises that players of the Boy Aquarium, aka hockey games, regularly showcase before matches. Williams got Fallon on the floor of the stage, first on the carpeted section in front of his desk, before moving them to the floor where Fallon performs his monologues, crouched down on all fours to stretch their hips. "This is the best it gets," Williams joked to the host, adding, "Johnny Carson didn't do this," before critiquing Fallon's form. When asked if he had been prepared for the stretch beforehand, Fallon emphasizes that he was only given a photo before he saw Williams go through the motions on air. "Let me just tell you something. I did not know what the stretch was going to get into. I just knew that he was going to teach me a stretch," Fallon said. "And the photo they sent me had a hockey player with two gloves on the ice, and he was kind of squatting like a catcher at baseball. I go, 'Do I need to know the stretch?' And they go, 'I'd rather you didn't know.'" Fallon continued, laughing, But I just trust my bit. So when we went to the floor and I'm like, "What is the stretch?" I saw a little bit. I thought it was like a child pose, yoga, you know? He's like, "No, it's more like this." Fallon recalled that Williams was in a good mood and feeling confident because the audience loved him. But the host wasn't so confident in his hip-stretching skills. "I don't even know if my kids can see it," the comic joked. "You almost had to blur something out, I'll say that." As soon as it aired, I had like 10 people send me the meme, and I go, "Oh my God," Fallon admitted. "Could be worse, but, you know, I actually loved it. And I thought it was so good. I loved the response from it because, you know, 2 years ago, there was no show. 2 weeks ago, everyone is talking about heated rivalry. And now it's all about Hudson Williams, you know?" Fallon mused that the quick shot to stardom is how fame kind of goes, adding that he enjoys seeing that happen and giving rising stars that platform. "I'm happy that he had faith in us, you know? And our guests have faith in us to do a good job," he shared. Reps for The Tonight Show shared that Williams' interview has already amassed 45 million views across the show's social and digital platforms. The host says he's proud of The Tonight Show and how it's become the place to celebrate fandoms from shows like Heated Rivalry and Stranger Things, to highly anticipated films such as Wicked and even music fandoms like K-pop. "I think they can trust us over these years," Fallon said of how the show has fostered an energy that attracts stars from all over. "We've done it so long, and I think there's a trust in our show and hopefully me, you know? I don't want to see you fall down. I want to see you score. I want everyone to win. So whoever's coming on the show, like, let's do it." The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon, airs weeknights at 11:35 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific Time on NBC. That was Jimmy Fallon likens fan frenzy for Heated Rivalry's Hudson Williams to Beatlemania, one of the hottest audiences we've ever had. It was by Mikishana Pierre. I'll take a quick break here to mention that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from their website, which is EW.com. We started talking about romantic comedy, so here are the 17 best romantic comedy movies on Netflix. Whether they concern enemies becoming lovers or complicated love triangles, you'll fall head over heels for these rom-coms that are currently streaming. This is by Kevin Jacobson and Angela Andaloro. And they've had this article before, but it was just updated this week. There are so many different ways you can fall in love, and romantic comedies serve to remind us of that. Maybe you're dreaming of an unexpected romance, like in Hitman. You could also be looking for a plot with strong female leads, such as the incredible Jessica James, or someone great. Whatever kind of love story you're in the mood for, you'll find your perfect match on our list of the best romantic comedies currently streaming on Netflix. That's as of right now, January 2026. These are in alphabetical order, and the first is Alex Strangelove from 2018. A coming-of-age rom-com that sees a popular teen wrestle with his sexuality may seem like a familiar narrative, but Alex Strangelove adds its own spin. Alex Truelove, played by Daniel Denny, lives in an especially progressive and supportive environment for a high school tale, nearly void of the common prejudices against queerness. Still, Alex doesn't know what or who he wants, and he has to learn about himself before he can know for sure. Many LGBTQ+ rom-coms tend to focus on protagonists that are working against societal biases, but Alex Strangelove offers a more joyful take on the queer experience. Entertainment Weekly's critic praises the film's underlying theme beneath its occasionally cringy twists and turns, writing, "It's hard to fault the bigger message here, that we all deserve the right to be true to who we are, even if it takes a few hard turns, and some collateral emotional damage to get there." At the time, Entertainment Weekly had given the movie a grade of B. Next, Along for the Ride from 2022. Based on the novel by Sarah Dessen, Night Owl Auden, played by Emma Passereau, displeases her type A mom, played by Andy McDowell, by going to stay with her absentee dad, played by Dermot Mulroney, his wife, Kate Bosworth, and their newborn over the summer before college. Now on a mission to taste all the teenage experiences she's missed out on, Auden soon makes her first real group of girlfriends and roams the beach town in the wee hours of the morning. Doing so brings her to meet another night type, Eli, played by Belmont Camille, who has a repressed past of his own. Sofia Alvarez is no stranger to teen rom-coms, given that she adapted To All the Boys I've Loved Before into the hit Netflix film franchise. Now she's made her feature-length directorial debut with Along for the Ride, having collaborated with Dessen, queen of the beach read, on this quintessential summer romance film. I have always really loved those nostalgic summertime movies that I grew up watching, and I think I immediately saw the potential for this movie to be one of those, Alvarez told Entertainment Weekly. I really wanted it to be the kind of summer movie where you smell the sunscreen through the screen, or it has a soundtrack that everyone is singing in their cars this summer when they're driving to the beach. Spoiler alert! This movie and its soundtrack by Beach House achieves all of that and more. Always Be My Maybe from 2019. Who says you can't go home again? Ali Wong shines in this romantic comedy about childhood best friends who cross paths as adults after an awkward teenage romance ended badly. Fast forward 16 years, and life has taken celebrity chef Sasha Tran, played by Wong, and unsuccessful musician Marcus Kim, played by Randall Park, to some very different places. Much has changed, but their chemistry sure hasn't, as the two come face to face with their many differences on the road to reconciliation. Co-stars Wong and Park are also co-writers for the film, and given the hilarity of Wong's Netflix stand-up specials, it's no wonder Always Be My Maybe was an instant hit. The Central Lovebirds have a lot of healing to do from their complicated youths before they can live happily ever after, but the laughter makes it that much sweeter. Throw in a disastrous double date featuring Keanu Reeves playing, well, Keanu Reeves, and you've got yourself a chaotic love triangle unlike any you've seen before. Entertainment Weekly's critic highlights the film's graceful lack of tokenism as well. Always Be My Maybe joins a burgeoning, if still too small, club of mainstream movies centered, without any special pomp or circumstance, on Asian American characters. Seriously, what's not to love? Entertainment Weekly had given it a grade of B. As Good as It Gets from 1997. This delightfully spiky rom-com from the great James L. Brooks, who we know from Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News, centers on flawed people who come together nonetheless. Jack Nicholson plays Melvin, a cynical novelist who strikes up a connection with a local waitress, Carol, played by Helen Hunt, with whom he embarks on an unlikely romance. As with many comedies of the 90s, not every element has aged well, but there's an old-fashioned charm to Brooks's writing and directing that sneaks up on you. Entertainment Weekly had given the movie a grade of B-. Friends with Benefits from 2011. With a similar plot to No Strings Attached and coming out the same year, Friends with Benefits tells the story of friends who decide to add sex into the equation. Though Benefits received notably better notices than Strings. The rom-com stars Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis as a pair of hot singles who become close friends and enjoy some of the titular benefits, only to find themselves developing feelings for each other. Naturally, both parties deny such feelings out loud, but it's impossible to deny the chemistry between them. Called by Entertainment Weekly's critic an outrageously synthetic confection that pleases and entertains in its very froth, Friends with Benefits unfold in a relatively predictable fashion, but sometimes that's exactly what you need from a diverting rom-com at the end of a long day. At the time, they gave the movie a grade of B-. Groundhog Day from 1993, always a good one. Groundhog Day has become virtually synonymous with this romantic time loop comedy as much as Punxsutawney Phil himself, popularizing the concept of an endless repeated day for numerous films to come. Groundhog Day centers on jaded TV weatherman Phil Connors, played by Bill Murray, who finds himself trapped in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, waking up over and over again on February 2nd. Only Phil is aware of the time loop, causing him to behave in a variety of ways, from taking advantage of his circumstances to get what he wants, to falling into existential despair. Time has been kind to Groundhog Day since its 1993 release, especially in how it blends laughs with moments of philosophical insight. The Half of It from 2020. In a modern retelling of the classic French play Cyrano de Bergerac, Ellie, played by Lee Lewis, starts ghostwriting love letters for a jock, Paul, played by Daniel Deemer, in exchange for some much-needed cash. But as she continues to correspond with Paul's dream girl, Aster, played by Alexis Lemire, Ellie finds that they have a lot in common and wonders if she's actually her better half. Though the romantic tension between the unknowing Aster and the unfortunate Ellie pushes the film forward, the true heart of this story is the blossoming friendship between Ellie and Paul. He may not be able to write to save his life, but Paul speaks up where it counts, causing an intimate and somewhat overlapping love triangle between teens who are just trying to learn what life is all about. The character's bond is rooted in Lewis and Deemer's genuine affection, too. "Daniel is like my brother now," Lewis told Entertainment Weekly. "His belief in me," as Daniel definitely translated on screen, where Ellie finds the courage to perform because of Paul's belief in her. At the time, Entertainment Weekly gave the movie a grade of B. Hitman from 2024. Talk about an unconventional meet-cute. Glenn Powell co-wrote and stars in this darkly comedic romantic thriller as Gary Johnson, a mild-mannered college professor who also works with the police posing as a hitman to bust murder-for-hire clients. He proves adept at his undercover job, but after a woman named Madison, played by Adria Ojona, hires Gary to kill her husband, he soon finds himself developing feelings, which complicates matters. Powell delivers his best performance to date as the chameleonic faux assassin, and his chemistry with Arjona is off the charts charming. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, from 2003. Entering a relationship with ulterior motives can only end in ruin. So what happens when both partners have a secret plan up their sleeves? Such is the premise for How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, in which advertising executive Ben, played by Matthew McConaughey, takes a bet that he can get a woman to fall in love with him in only 10 days, while magazine writer Andy, played by Kate Hudson, hopes to write an article about getting a man to break up with her in the same amount of time. Naturally, they are set up with each other and chaos ensues. While receiving mixed reviews from critics, the film is certainly representative of the rom-com genre in the early 2000s, largely holding up due to the chemistry between McConaughey and Hudson. The pair reunited in February 2023 to discuss why they worked so well together, with McConaughey telling Hudson, "What tickles me doesn't bruise you, and what tickles you doesn't bruise me. We were never afraid to push it to what might be considered too far." The Incredible Jessica James from 2017. Jessica Williams from Two Dope Queens and Shrinking is a relatable force to be reckoned with in her debut lead role. As the uber-confident Jessica James, she's trying to find out what's next in both her work life and her love life, with New York City as the backdrop. However, a blind date throws a wrench in all her plans as she finds herself unexpectedly falling for Boone, played by Chris O'Dowd, though she's still not quite over her ex, Damon, played by Lakeith Stanfield. While the love story at the center of The Incredible Jessica James may seem a little tropey and basic at times, the protagonist is anything but that. Jessica is a joyful, empowered character who faces her mistakes head-on without beating herself up about them. Entertainment Weekly's critic celebrates the rom-com for its not-so-delicate balance, writing, "Even when the film falls into indie cliches, Williams keeps things moving with her cleverness and charisma. Whether she's chastising man-spreaders on the subway or introducing an as-yet-unborn baby to the fight to dismantle the patriarchy." At the time, they gave the movie a grade of B+. The Lovebirds from 2020. The relationship between Leilani, played by Issa Rae, and Gibran, played by Kumail Nanjiani, is on its last legs and fading fast when the struggling couple is invited to a dinner party. On their way there, a chance encounter with a criminal changes the course of their night and their separation. If they want to make it out alive and clear their names, the two will have to work together, but not without throwing a few passive-aggressive jabs at each other in the process. The Lovebirds gives viewers a different kind of second-chance romance. It's light on the romance and heavy on the antics, making it an honest portrayal of all that can make or break a relationship, romantic or not. Still, the chemistry between Rae and Nanjiani eliminates any question of their potential as a couple. They bicker in that comfortable, weathered way that shows strain, but that edge may be just what they need to see their situation to the other side. And confronting it all is just as challenging as solving the murder they witnessed. Entertainment Weekly's critic notes, "What feels freshest, maybe, is the mere fact of two leads of color taking on all the tropes of the genre and making it feel as modern as they do. Entertainment Weekly gave it a grade of B. Moulin Rouge from 2001. At one point in this musical from visionary director Baz Luhrmann, Jim Broadbent's Harold Zidler proclaims, "Spectacular, spectacular, no words in the vernacular." This is also a fitting description of Moulin Rouge itself, a dazzling ode to love and loss set against the backdrop of Paris at the turn of the 20th century. Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor play star-crossed lovers Satine and Christian, whose desire to be together is challenged by forces outside of their control. Frenetically edited and unabashedly over the top, Moulin Rouge may be a bit of an acquired taste. Entertainment Weekly's critic calls it a whirling fantasia of Rococo kitsch. But it's a glorious experience for those who believe in the power of truth, beauty, freedom, and love. Mr. and Mrs. Smith from 2005. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie star as John and Jane Smith, a couple whose marriage is on shaky ground. They also happen to both be skilled assassins, though neither is aware of the other's occupation. This all changes when they're both assigned to kill the same target, which complicates everything to the point that they're soon tasked with killing each other. Hijinks ensue, and the film is propelled by the undeniable chemistry between Pitt and Jolie, who Entertainment Weekly's critic writes have a chemical zing. Thus, Brangelina was born. Set It Up from 2018. Overworked assistants Charlie, played by Glenn Powell, and Harper, played by Zoe Deutsch, have a corporate meet-cute in their shared office building when they bond over their demanding, miserable bosses. Venture capitalist Rick Otis, played by Taye Diggs, and sports media maven Kirsten Stevens, played by Lucy Liu. Desperate to make their jobs and lives easier, Charlie and Harper hatch a plan to merge their superiors into a happy power couple, but playing matchmaker might be way above their pay grade. A romantic comedy in the same vein as The Devil Wears Prada, this film has its share of gaslighting, but the twist is its good intentions. Charlie and Harper feel genuine admiration for their successful bosses, and though their motives are self-serving, it's all in the name of love, right? What follows is a satisfying take on the feel-good genre, complete with meditations on work lives, love lives, and everything in between. Entertainment Weekly's critic hails Set It Up as the gold standard for the frothy summer rom-com, and she was right on the money. They had given the movie a grade of B. She's Gotta Have It is number 15 of 17. That's from 1986. Spike Lee exploded onto the scene with his 1986 directorial debut. Made for only $175,000, She's Gotta Have It tells the story of Nola, played by Tracy Camilla Johns, a graphic artist in Brooklyn who juggles relationships with three men, each with their own distinct personality. The situation becomes complicated after the men meet and figure out what's happening. Meanwhile, Nola comes to realize the value of her freedom as a sexually liberated person. Lauded for its depiction of a confident black woman at the time when Hollywood rarely centered on such characters, She's Gotta Have It proved to be predictive of the kinds of groundbreaking stories Lee would tell in the decades to come. The Oscar-winning filmmaker also adapted the film into a Netflix series in 2017. Someone Great from 2019. This charming directorial debut by Jennifer Caden Robinson proves that breakup movies can make for great rom-coms. Jenny, played by Gina Rodriguez, lands her dream job at Rolling Stone, but it costs her her longtime boyfriend, played by Lakeith Stanfield. Desperate for a last hurrah in New York City before her big move, the new bachelorette rallies friends Blair, played by Brittany Snow, and Aaron, played by DeWanda Wise, to help send her off, though it proves to be anything but a clean break. The misadventures of their big night out inspire each woman to reflect on whether they've been choosing their relationships over themselves. The result is an empowering, modern spin on what's expected from the genre, placing sisterhood and self-love at the center stage. Ever the rom-com expert, Entertainment Weekly's critic heralds Something Great as a newer breed of movie, the scrappy female POV, in which the love story at the center is as much about friendship or the face in the mirror as it is about any one man. At the time, they gave the movie a grade of B+. And our last on the list is To All the Boys I've Loved Before from 2018. One of the better teen rom-coms for the modern age, To All the Boys I've Loved Before was a smashing success for Netflix upon its 2018 release. Lana Condor plays Laura Jean Covey, a high schooler who secretly pens love letters to crushes but never sends them. Her younger sister finds them stashed away and decides to mail them herself, leading to a fair share of awkward situations. To prevent her current crush from initiating yet another cringy confrontation, she impulsively kisses one of her former crushes, played by Noah Centineo, which proves to be the catalyst for an ever-evolving relationship. To All the Boys I've Loved Before was very well received, with Entertainment Weekly's critic calling it breezy and charming. Netflix released two sequels to the film, To All the Boys, P.S. I Still Love You, in 2020, and To All the Boys, Always and Forever, in 2021, though the original remains the series' best entry. At the time, they gave it a grade of B. Those are the 17 best romantic comedy movies on Netflix right now as I'm recording this, and it was by Kevin Jacobson and Angela Andaloro. And to wrap us up in this rom-com theme, here, Julia Roberts thought Notting Hill sounded so effing stupid, the dumbest idea of any movie I could ever do. It's by Wesley Stenzel. Julia Roberts wasn't impressed by the idea of Notting Hill. The After the Hunt star revealed her initial skepticism about the iconic 1999 romantic comedy during an interview with Deadline. "Gosh, I just remember when my agent called me about Notting Hill and I thought, well, that sounds like the dumbest idea of any movie I could ever do," Roberts remembered. The film saw Roberts portray an A-list Hollywood star who falls in love with a shopkeeper, played by Hugh Grant, as she tries to stay low in London. The Pretty Woman actress was not particularly enthused by that premise. "I'm going to play the world's biggest movie star and I do what?" she recalls thinking. "And then what happens? This sounds so effing stupid." However, upon reading Richard Curtis's screenplay, Roberts changed her tune. "And then I read the script and I was like, oh, this is so charming. It's so funny. Oh, S," she remembered. "And then I went to lunch with Richard Curtis and producer Duncan Kenworthy and beloved director Roger Mitchell, may he rest in peace." Despite being charmed by the script, Roberts said that she initially took that lunch meeting to tell the filmmakers that she intended to pass on the film. "And they were just so charming and sweet and fun," she said, "and I thought, wow, this is really going to happen." Roberts remembers the Notting Hill experience with fondness. "We had a beautiful time doing it. It was cast to perfection by Mary Selway. All the friends, everybody," she said. "It was so great, and we had a beautiful time. And I think Roger, he just created the film in a way that it just, at every turn, it succeeded. It accomplished its goals." The My Best Friend's Wedding actress previously said that she had reservations about portraying a fictional actress during a conversation with Curtis for British Vogue in 2024. "Honestly, one of the hardest things I've ever had to do was your movie playing a movie actress," she said. "I was so uncomfortable. I mean, We've talked about this so many times, but I almost didn't take the part because it just seemed, so awkward. I didn't even know how to play that person. Roberts also reflected on her approach to acting in comedy films like Notting Hill in her conversation with Deadline. There is a math, but I think it changes depending on the kind of comedy that it is, she said, noting that advice she received from the director of Pretty Woman and Runaway Bride. Gary Marshall would always say that a joke is in three parts, like a drumbeat. I mean, people have their different ways of looking at it. She continued, for me, I think it would just depend on what the goal is. But I mean, the joy of life is making people laugh for me, especially my husband. If I can make my husband really laugh because he makes me really laugh, then it just fills me up. That was Julia Roberts thought Notting Hill sounded so effing stupid, the dumbest idea of any movie I could ever do. And it was by Wesley Stenzel. And that finishes up our time for Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury. Thank you for listening to all these rom-com stories. It was a good theme from start to finish. Please come back next week. I'm sure we'll have a bit of a recap from the Golden Globes, and we'll hear about who won the awards. Until then, goodbye.